1323105 CV, Christine Nicole Torres versus Stephanie Garcia, Max Galvan, and Juan R. Garcia.
May please the court. Good morning, Chief Justice Contreras, Justice Benavides, and Justice Tijerina. My name is Katrina Guerrero, and I represent the appellant, Christine Torres. The basis of this appeal involves two issues: whether there was legally and factually sufficient evidence to support, one, plaintiff's award for past and future medical, and two, plaintiff's award for past and future physical impairment. The answer to both of those questions is no. Plaintiffs failed to present expert testimony establishing how and why this minor accident caused severe, complex soft tissue injuries. And plaintiffs also failed to show an impediment having a substantial effect on their life that extends beyond the injuries that were compensable through other damage elements.
So just really quick, you are not contesting then the amount that was awarded by the jury on future physical pain and suffering and past physical pain and suffering?
No.
All right.
Shifting to the medical expenses, when an accident victim seeks to recover medical expenses, they need to show what the conditions were that generated those expenses and that the conditions were caused by the accident. Expert testimony is necessary to establish conditions that are outside of the common knowledge and experience of jurors. And specifically, Texas courts have identified soft tissue back and neck injuries as being conditions outside of the common knowledge and experience of jurors, therefore requiring expert testimony.
Do you agree, though, that some aspects of this award can be supported by lay testimony? I think you're arguing more the medical evidence in terms of the actual diagnoses, and am I correct?
There are some instances where lay testimony would support causation. However, in this case, because of the ultimate diagnoses of these plaintiffs, which is cervicalgia, radiculopathy, bulging discs, those specific diagnoses require expert testimony because they're outside of the common knowledge of a lay juror. We're not talking about the generalized soreness that one might feel.
Yeah, but much of the medical testimony that was provided and the evidence that was put in front of the jury was of soft tissue type of surgery. I mean, we call it cervicalgia, but it's neck pain, back pain. And isn't there enough case law out there that says that that type of injury, at least to a certain extent, can be substantiated by non-expert testimony, or at least the testimony that was provided in this case?
There's several cases that specifically say that cervicalgia, herniated discs, and really the injuries that are very similar to the ones that plaintiffs are claiming they suffered in this case do require expert testimony.
Do you think a chiropractor is sufficient testimony to provide the causation for these injuries? Or do we need a medical doctor? Because I know there's always been the fight and disagreement between medical doctors and chiropractors.
Right. I think if they could qualify the chiropractor as being able to testify how and why these injuries arose from this particular accident, I think that could be sufficient. But in this case, we don't have any testimony that lends towards how and why this minor accident caused these complex soft tissue injuries. He merely testified that the accident caused the injury. He never explains, how the plaintiff's bodies moved or how we can expect that.
Well, that's usually a biomechanical expert, the one that testifies as to the biomechanics. So are you saying in these type of cases now we not only need some type of medical expert, we now need a biomechanical expert?
No, I think that a medical doctor or a chiropractor can still be qualified to provide that basic testimony as to how and why these injuries arose from the accident. I don't think that this is a situation where in every case across the board you need two experts.
You're just saying that it didn't happen here.
Correct. In this particular case, we just did not have sufficient testimony that provided that link to the juror to establish causation of plaintiff's past and future medical.
But perhaps he could have been a little bit more detailed, but he did relate the symptoms that each were experiencing to the accident, didn't he?
In this case, he merely outlined what their diagnosis was and explained what each one meant, But at the end of the day, he was simply asked, did this accident cause the injuries? And he responded, yes.
So what more would be required, do you think?
I think that we would need more detailed testimony establishing how the impact and one's body would move or a shift that would cause bulging discs in this case. You know, under the facts of this case, we just have, this was a very minor accident. Plaintiff Garcia, she was the driver of the vehicle. She testified that she came to a complete stop. She had barely taken off, and the vehicles impacted a very short distance from where she had barely taken off. They were wearing their seatbelts. They did not, the airbags did not deploy. EMS wasn't called. They did not report any injuries on the scene. So in that case, we need to understand how and why this minor accident would cause a bulging disc, and specifically in this case, why those injuries, even though plaintiffs were successfully discharged from treatment, will continue to require treatment into the future, as the plaintiffs contend in this case. And I want to focus on future medical treatment very briefly. There's no mention of the that in all reasonable medical probability that specifically Plaintiff Garcia will require future medical treatment. The expert never testified that she will need care into the future. The only time that the necessity of future care is brought up is with respect to Plaintiff Galvan. And specifically, the expert was asked, do you have an opinion as to whether or not he will require treatment in the future? And the expert responded, yes, we did send him home with some home exercises and stretching.
So that was only to Galvan, and there was never that same question to Garcia?
That's correct. There was never that same question posed to Garcia. And then immediately following that, he's asked to speculate how much medical care would cost if the symptoms were to arise in the future. This is not evidence of future medical. Under Laura V. Bowie, this is insufficient testimony to support a future medical award because it's testimony that merely suggests that future medical may be needed in the future, and not rather than the probability that it will be.
So he should have said in reasonable medical probability it will incur in the future? Is that what you're saying?
No. When experts testify under reasonable medical probability, it has to be more than just using that particular language. We go to the substance of what their testimony is. And when we look at the substance of the testimony, he testifies that he saw them, he treated them, they were successfully discharged. But he never explains why, in all reasonable medical probability, even though they were successfully discharged, that they will still continue, or specifically, that Mr. Galvan will still continue to require treatment well into the future.
Do they need to detail the type of work that might need to be done, how long it might need to go to the future, and how much it would cost?
Yes, and that's all required to establish future medical, and that's what's also lacking here, is that he doesn't explain what additional treatments would be needed. I mean, beyond home stretches and exercises, which arguably don't require that he seek a medical provider.
Well, would you agree with me that a doctor such as Dr. Luna is allowed to hypothetically, I mean, we've always had this problem with no one has a crystal ball, no one can really say what's going to happen to either one of these plaintiffs in the future, and specifically Mr. But there was a question asked of Dr. Luna on page, I believe it's about 123 of volume 2, where he says Mr. Galvan was had been moved and was doing sedentary work, and then he was moved to a more physical job, and the effect of that, and Dr. Luna definitely said, well, that will definitely affect his ability and allow him to exasperate his injuries, I believe is the testimony. But isn't that sufficient in order to elaborate as to what would require if Mr. Galvan needed future meds?
In this case, no. He never testified directly that the reason that he sought future medical treatment was related to this particular accident. And there's also evidence that Mr. Galvan was in a subsequent accident that he sought treatment for. So there's no explanation that links for the jury that this accident in 2019 will continue to cause Mr. Galvan pain and require medical treatment, you know, here in 2024 and well beyond. And as Justice Tijerina pointed out, we don't know what specific type of future medical care he would require and the duration of that medical care. Again, he's just asked to speculate what the cost would be if his pain arised. And he testified, I believe, around a couple thousand dollars a year. But without more, that's just merely speculative testimony. Under these facts, it just doesn't logically flow that because of this minor accident, plaintiffs will continue to suffer soft tissue injuries as a result of this accident and will require treatment well into the future without some expert testimony linking that how and why. An expert's bare assertions that one incident caused the other is never sufficient evidence to establish medical causation. And an expert needs to go further and explain how the breach caused the injury. Plaintiffs cannot just simply hand over their medical records to establish causation. For one, lay jurors don't have the knowledge to understand the intricacies that go into diagnosing soft tissue injuries.
Mrs. Guerra, I'm going to interrupt you only because you're running short on time, because I want to move into physical impairment and ask you if that is necessary to have expert testimony on physical impairment.
No, physical impairment is not necessary to have expert testimony. We don't argue that it is. The basis of the physical impairment argument is that there's just no evidence that rises to the level of physical impairment. Physical impairment is not meant to compensate plaintiffs for the pain that they feel. Physical impairment is meant to compensate plaintiffs for the loss of enjoyment of their life, or when there is evidence of a specific task or activity that they can no longer do or perform, or that is substantially inhibited as a result of the accident.
It seems that the majority of the testimony on physical impairment was through Max as opposed to Stephanie, although Max testified about Stephanie's impairment. Is that sufficient?
No, the evidence that, or Max's testimony, Mr. Galvan's testimony, was merely just evidence of their pain that they feel. I believe he specifically testified about feeling pain when moving a sofa with his friends. And although plaintiff's brief identifies that as an inability to lift heavy objects, what that testimony really is that he feels pain when moving a sofa, and that's not sufficient evidence of physical impairment. That's evidence of pain, which he was already compensated for. A jury's award for physical impairment requires sufficient evidence of a substantial and disabling loss, which we simply don't have here in this case. And if the panel has no further questions.
I just want to be clear that you said that you weren't seeking anything with regards to the past and future pain and suffering, correct?
Correct. We're not challenging
that
award.
But you're also asking us to find that the facts are insufficient to support a finding of past medical and future medical expenses, correct?
Correct.
Now, don't we need a concrete injury to substantiate the award for pain and suffering? So if this panel were to say, yeah, you're right, no physical injury, or medicals in the past and no medicals in the future, wouldn't that negate the pain and suffering on both of those?
I don't think so. When we review the awards for past medical and future medical, we're talking about the actual services that they received. Plaintiffs can still testify through lay testimony that after this accident they felt pain, and that could be sufficient to substantiate the awards for past and future pain. But again, expert testimony.
So that you're conceding then they could have an injury, but it didn't, the award of the medicals past and future are not substantiated.
Correct. If the panel has no further questions, I'll reserve the
I just wanted to ask to make sure that we were all on the same base in your last 20 seconds. The standard of review on this is that as we as a court review to affirm a jury verdict unless there is no evidence of it at all, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
Thank you. Ms. Julia?
May it please the court, Chief Justice Contreras, Justice Benavides, Justice Tijerina. It's been 22 years since I've been here, so excuse me if I'm a little...
I was going to give you a hard time. And I think, Mrs. Christina, this is your first oral argument? Are you on your first oral argument?
No.
Second.
Charged before us in corpus.
This is my first one with you in front of me. All right.
I have to say, after trying this case and receiving their brief, I thought, oh my gosh, has the law changed? Now in simple car accident cases, we have to have a biomechanical engineer to explain how and why the, you know, bodies move around, and then we have to have experts to prove up medicals. And so I, you know, start reading the brief because, I mean, that's the way it was set out. I thought either the law has changed or they're seeking to change the way we do simple car accident cases. And so I start looking at the brief and I start reading the cases. And yeah, they cite more recent cases from Westlaw, but every one of those go back to cite three Texas Supreme Court cases. They're all citing either the Guevara case, the JLB trucking case, or the Jelinek case. And in every one of those cases, yes, expert testimony was required, but that's because in every one of those cases, if evidence presents other plausible causes of an injury, then you've got to have an expert come and say, well, why was it the accident instead of the butler in the pantry with the candlestick? I mean, so...
Well, but you need an expert, even in this case, to explain the MRI, for instance, and, you know, the diagnosis. That's not something that's, I think, would be common knowledge.
You would, except for the fact that, look at Burroughs Welcome Company. You know, that case has held, and we always have held, that you can have competent medical causation evidence expressed in testimony or in medical records. So in this case, you know, the medical records were good enough on their own, and those were exhibits 22 and 24. They talked about, you know, how the accident happened, the examination of the patients, what the subjective complaints were, what the objective evaluation was, then gave the diagnosis, and then gave an opinion based upon reasonable medical probability. So
you're saying it would be sufficient just to admit the records, not have anybody testify to them at all, and just as you argued to them, I don't have time to go through them, look at them.
Yes.
That would be enough.
Absolutely. Always has been. But if there is a situation where you've got more than one, you know, if you've got evidence of more than one plausible explanation, then you have to have an expert come and say, why was it the car accident?
Well, I think that what the defendant is attempting to argue is that in this circumstances, because in this case, the motor vehicle was so minor, right? There was, that's what their whole brief is about. This was a very low impact, no damages kind of case, that because of this type of motor vehicle, if there had been damaged AirPods deployed, I think they would be probably arguing something else. But I think that's what the point they're trying to make in their brief.
Well, and I think, Justice Benavides, it goes to the question that you asked when they were arguing, which was, what is our standard of review here? And the standard of review is we look at the evidence that supports the jury finding, and instead the only evidence that they presented is the argument that they made at the trial court, which was rejected. This was not just a minor accident. They want to focus on how fast Ms. Garcia was going because she had just started from a stop. They don't want to focus on the fact that their client was zooming down Jonquil, and I quote from the Volume 3, Reporter's Record, page 56, when the defendant in the case said, I'm sorry, I dropped my coffee and I leaned to get it, I leaned over and I swerved into your lane. The evidence that was presented by the plaintiffs was this was a major impact, that it was a hard hit. The evidence was that the car was barely limped it around from Jonquil to Iris, where it was never driven again. The exhibit number 18, which came from their automotive expert, said that my client's vehicle was totaled. It spent 7 days in the shop, and she repaired it for $3,200 because it had sentimental value because it was given to her by her father before he suffered a life-altering stroke and was never able to work again. So it was so minor, it was just a little nothing. That argument, those facts were rejected by the jury, And it is not this court's job to be able, you know, you can't say, well, I kind of like those facts better. That's not the standard of review.
Right.
So we go back and we say, all right, if the jury believed that it was more than a minor impact, the car was totaled, it was not drivable, and they then it's not one of those cases where you need to have some fancy expert. And so, and the thing is, you know, look at those cases that they're citing. Jelinek was a medical malpractice case. Every medical malpractice case has to have an expert testify. And also in that case, the woman went into the hospital being eaten from the inside by metastatic cancer, and then had multiple surgeries, had multiple infections, and had a very bad course, and ultimately died. I mean, they had to put fans in her room to blow away the putrid smells. And the plaintiff said that all of her problems were caused because the hospital withheld two antibiotics for 4 days. And their expert was unable to say why it wasn't all the other problems. Their expert was unable to quantify.
So since we're talking about a subsequent or an incident or an activity, how do we deal with Mr. Galvan's subsequent motor vehicle accident and derive it, or it being derivative, as it pertains to future medical expenses?
That's a very good question. And Dr. Luna addressed it. Because, I would agree that in this case, with regards to Max Galvan specifically, I agree that an expert was required to come and say, well, why was it accident number two instead of accident number one or accident number three? And that's why we brought Dr. Luna. Because I do agree. I just want to make it clear that the way their brief was written and the way they've argued is they're saying that an expert is required in every automobile case, and that is not true. In this case, I didn't need one for Stephanie Garcia. Stephanie Garcia had never been in a, she'd never had a slip and fall, never had any injury, she'd never had a work-related accident, she had no symptoms, she had never been to a doctor. I mean, the only possible cause of this was this automobile accident. So I would argue that it was unnecessary. With Max Galvan, yes, it was. We needed to have that. That's why Dr. Luna came and said, well, I know it wasn't the first accident because I treated him for that. He had an MRI for that accident. He then was discharged symptom-free, remained symptom-free for 2 years before this accident occurred. And in this one, he has new symptoms, including pain that was radiating down his buttocks. He had an MRI for this one, which showed a 2-point whatever millimeter herniation at L4, L5, which did not exist on the prior MRI. Therefore, I know it was accident number two. So then you're asked, okay, well, why wasn't it accident number three? That was such a minor accident. He had 6 visits to a chiropractor for a little tweak and went on his way. So the pain then didn't reoccur until he starts climbing the turbines. Now, he's not carrying anything heavy. He's not... You know, it's yes, he's climbing the turbines. Same thing as if you were climbing a ladder to clean the gutters at your house. Same thing if you were, you know, climbing stairs, which you don't normally have to do in the valley. And what happened? The pain reemerged. He said, the same except worse as I experienced after this accident. So again, that showed that that goes also to the physical impairment. But going back to the causation...
Well, let's stop there for just a minute. So then Dr. Luna talks about, at that point, these future medical expenses. Now, let's not talk about impairment, because that's different than future medical expenses. Is the testimony he provides at about a page 120 to 123 sufficient to get you the $25,000 that this jury gave you for Mr. Galvan?
Yes. And the reason is because, first of all, we go back to the actual medical records, which says flare-ups are anticipated to result in future medicals of $2,000 to $2,500 a year. So then you look at, you don't necessarily just need Dr. Luna to say, you look at the other facts. What did Max testify? Not only did his pain return after he had been discharged from Dr. Luna, but he required more physical therapy, which he was undergoing in Wisconsin 3 times a week. So it wasn't speculative, it was. It happened. And so the jury's award of $25,000 is only giving them 10 years worth of flare-ups. We already know that they had 2 years of flare-ups, you know, between the time that the accident occurred and the time that we got to trial. So we know it's not speculative because it happened. It is happening. It's continuing to happen. They are undergoing continuing treatment. And the same with Stephanie.
Same with Stephanie.
Because Stephanie testified that, I mean, these kids, they don't have kids. They don't have pets. You know, they like barbecuing with their family. They're not, you know, every once in a while he would help his friends move a sofa or you know, and go work out at the gym. But what she testified that she loved was her job. And at her job where she would, you know, have to walk, stand, and look down to assist during procedures. And that she was not able to do that anymore. And that they had to move her to a different job. It is reasonable.
So is that enough for the physical impairment? Because we've always debated, and there's lots of case law as to what exactly physical impairment is. It's not
non-job related.
Non-job related. And so that you're right, Chief. So is that sufficient? I mean, I always tell this story, and I'm just going to take a moment. You know, I had a guy testify, well, you know, his wife couldn't make him tortillas after his accident. And so that was his physical impairment. I fully understood that. So was there enough testimony, aside from what you attested to or just spoke about, to get us to physical impairment? Let's switch.
Yes. And the reason is, look, if... You know, even the cases that they cite, like the Patliak, says limitations on mobility, such as being unable to rotate one's head completely or normally, would have obvious impact on day-to-day activities, such as driving, responding to one's name when called, recreational activities. And many, many, many cases have found that activities such as walking, eating, kneeling, standing, climbing, yard work,
go ahead, Chief.
Well, in that same case that you just cited, though, there's a laundry list of symptoms similar to some of the ones testified to here. And the court in that case said that evidence appears indistinguishable from pain and suffering, et cetera. And the only one they took out was the neck pain.
Well, actually, in that case...
To support physical impairment.
But actually, in that case, what he testified to was... I have terrible pain when I'm using a jackhammer at work and when I'm moving heavy pipe at work. And in that case, his lawyers had asked the jury for lost wages and lost earning capacity. So it was indistinguishable. You couldn't tell the difference. So and that goes. And I'll tell you, it reminds me. You say, in this case, we didn't ask for lost wages or loss of earning capacity because they didn't lose wages and they didn't lose earning capacity. They actually have better paying jobs now. So you say, but if this is where they're having this impairment, like with Ms. Garcia, it is reasonable to say, you know, when that girl has a kid, she's going to spend a lot of time standing, bending over. It's called changing diapers. And it's reasonable to infer that the physical impairment that she's suffering at work is going to go on to normal everyday things. So there can't be a confusion in this case that, oh, they put something in this category that should have gone in this other category because we didn't ask for the other category.
Isn't it enough that she's not enjoying her job as much because she's not being able to do what she enjoys doing more? I think you said she enjoyed assisting in the surgeries and she couldn't do that.
And so I argue, yes, it is enough, and that's physical impairment. I can't call it something different because she didn't lose work and she's not making less money. So, and again, and I didn't ask for mental anguish, so it can't be confused with that. It is impairment. I cannot stand with my head down without, you know, I mean, I can't do it anymore. I've had to move to another job. And with her, again, going to her... to show the futures and why it wasn't speculative, a year after she had been discharged, one of the girls from her work went out on maternity leave, and so she went back to assist in the back, and it was so painful and so awful, she was right back in therapy again. So again, we're not speculating that they're gonna have these problems that are gonna require futures. It is, it has already, you know, begun to happen.
I have the same question for you that I had for Ms. Guerrero, is the testimony on future impairment, seems that, I'm sorry, I'm using first names here because that's what's in my notes, that Max testified as to Stephanie's future impairment. Is that sufficient to support an award?
Sure. Absolutely. Absolutely. You can always have a friend, a coworker, a family member, someone that knows you can testify as to, you know, physical pain, physical impairment, mental anguish, all of those things. You can have somebody else testify. Look at, you know, for example, all the cases that they cite that are Supreme Court cases, the Jelinek case, the plaintiff and the woman was deceased. In the Guerrero case, the man that was injured was deceased. And in that case, even though no expert testified at all, it was a little old man who had a list of comorbidities as long as my arm, and he was involved in an accident where he is the passenger, and he had a seatbelt on, and right away he complained of pain to his abdomen. He was taken by ambulance to the hospital. He had abdominal surgery. Now, I don't know how this happens in these cases where none of his medical records were introduced into evidence and no doctor testified, and yet he was allowed to introduce over $1 million worth of bills. And the Supreme Court said the widow and the driver of the car saying that he was wearing a seatbelt, complained of abdominal pain, was transported, and had abdominal surgery, that was good enough for causation on those issues. But there's $1 million worth of other things on these bills that we have no idea what it is. So you need an expert to come and explain how it's related to the car accident and why it's not related to his arm length full of comorbidities. So, you know, the other one that, again, all the cases that they cite go back to things like JLB trucking, Zapata. Gotta love cases in Zapata. You know, lady is hit by an 18-wheeler. Woo, she's not transported to the hospital. She goes supposedly to a clinic, although there's no record of it. And then she ends up at Dr. Pichetto. She has a little therapy, no MRIs, and she is released. She is released from care. And then she has another accident. And yet her lawyers want to blame everything on the first accident. The defendants have an expert to say everything that she has is either degenerative in nature or was caused by the second accident, which, by the way, she was extracted, put on one of those hard boards, strapped down, C-collar, and taken off to the hospital. And the judge in Zapata said, none of that business regarding the second accident is relevant. I will not allow any testimony about it at all. I mean, come on. Yes, I mean, all of the facts presented in those cases were situations where you needed to have an expert testify as to how this car accident caused your injuries and why it wasn't X, Y, and Z. So, I mean, in this case, and again, we can go through every one of the little cases that, you know, that they cited. City of Laredo versus Garza. It's a workers' comp case where the guy was throwing heavy carpet in the trash. He broke his kneecap and hurt his ankle, and he didn't complain about his back for 3 months. And the only testimony was from the TDI doctor that said the back had nothing to do with the injury. He had no expert to say, there was no evidence, nothing in a medical record, and no expert to say that his back injury was related to the fall. Wright versus Simpson. That one showed that she had a prior accident in 2009, and that after this accident, she was asymptomatic. She was doing quite well. She had no treatment for over 2 years. The records reflected degenerative issues, and she had no expert to come to testify why, and now all of a sudden it was, you know, this accident. Kelly versus Aldine ISD. Substitute teacher falls on fruit. She makes a workers' comp claim. They pay for treatment to her neck, back, knees, and ankles. But she wanted the stuff for herniations and radiculopathy. The only doctor that testified was the one that actually treated her and said, that's unrelated. She had no testimony to say that her herniations or radiculopathy were related to her fall. So,
let me ask you one more question on the physical impairment, and that is the standard that requires that it be substantial impairment. Do you think that the evidence in this record rises to that level?
Well, if other cases, including Harris County versus Smith, and then the Patlick and the Supreme Court cases that it cite to, say that testimony regarding sleeping, getting up, walking, exercises, is sufficient to affirm an award for physical impairment, we certainly had that here. They couldn't get comfortable when they were sleeping. They, you know, woke up, you know, with terrible stiffness. This continued. They had problems climbing. They had problems, you know, they couldn't even enjoy their barbecue. There was sufficient. So I do believe that.
I think that there's some, you know, we've always had a problem, both case law on what physical impairment is and what is substantial. And I know that there's some evidence of them and how it has affected their life. The question becomes, as the Chief just says, is it a substantial? Because then you, I know that you didn't ask for mental language, and I know that you didn't ask for loss, but they did get awarded pain and suffering. So is this still something under pain and suffering and not truly a physical impairment of what something they can't do?
If you can't climb a ladder without having pain shooting through your buttocks, that is physical impairment.
Okay.
If you cannot stand and have your head pointed down without suffering terrible, excruciating headaches and pain, that is physical impairment. That is different from, I have a headache.
Okay, we got it.
Thank you.
Thank you. It's good to see you back. Did you see, did you miss it? I want to start, Ms. Guerrero, with this physical impairment, because as you can see, the law has kind of stretched itself backwards and forwards in the 35 years I've been practicing law, the mm-hmm. physical impairment. So, and it's overridden into pain and suffering and mental language and loss of endorsement. So where do we put where people are injured and, for the sake of argument, assuming they can't climb ladders enough? Is that sufficient to be a substantial physical impairment?
In a situation where somebody could not climb a ladder, yes. But under this record, there's no evidence that Mr. Galvan could not climb a ladder. I believe counsel said that he was climbing ladders and he didn't have anything on his back. But the record actually does show he was carrying probably about upwards of 50 pounds worth of equipment while climbing up and down those wind turbines.
Okay, let's say he can climb the ladder, but it causes him to then, for the next 3 days, to be in excruciating pain because of what he just did, or one day, whatever amount you want it to be. Is that sufficient for a substantial physical impairment? That, i.e., I'm not going to be climbing ladders because then I'm going to be in excruciating pain thereafter.
I don't think in this case it would be, because that would go towards evidence of pain. What he's experiencing as a result of climbing the ladder is pain, not that he can no longer or is substantially inhibited from climbing that ladder. The physical impairment cases, a lot of them, the examples that they use are, I have limited range of motion in my neck, therefore it inhibits my ability to drive. I can no longer pick up my children. I can no longer play with my children. I can't mow my lawn anymore because of this, because of the pain caused by the accident. I am prevented from doing these things. In this situation, we have the plaintiffs complaining of pain, and that does not rise to the level of having an extreme disabling loss like the cases contemplate for physical impairment awards. And I think this is where courts, the line gets blurry for courts sometimes, and they have acknowledged that they generally don't like physical impairment awards because it can lead to double compensation for the exact same injuries.
Yeah, right.
So in a case where we have someone saying, I have pain when I stand, where do we draw that line between, well, you were already compensated for pain and suffering, now there's going to be a separate damage amount for your pain that you feel standing? Where's the difference between that pain? And here, there's just simply no evidence of physical impairment. That what plaintiffs rely on heavily is just their pain, that he felt pain while moving a sofa. She felt pain during these oral surgeries. And I believe Mr. Galvan testified, you know, that him and his fiance just had pain in general. I mean, that's his testimony, that they had pain in general. But where is the specific task or activity that they can no longer do or are substantially inhibited from doing as a result of this accident?
Well, what about Stephanie's testimony that she could no longer stand and assist with the surgeries, and therefore she had to do, which is what she enjoyed doing at work, and now she has to do something different, as I asked Ms. Julia?
That would go towards the element of pain. Again, we were blurring that
line.
Well,
if you can't stand, let's just say she was, I don't know, she liked to crochet. So she can't stand and do this movement anymore, so she says, I can't crochet anymore. That would be definitely an impairment. If it's being related to work, why is that different to make it different under an impairment?
I think the case law has specifically identified that physical impairment requires a distinct non-work-related activity that the party can no longer perform as a result of the accident. To go back to your crocheting example, that's a good example of a hobby, a task, something that would cause someone to lose enjoyment of their life as a result of the accident. And here, there's just not sufficient evidence that would rise to the level of physical impairment to substantiate either award for past or future physical impairment. The court or if the panel has no other questions, I'll give the remainder of my time.
No questions. Thank you very much to both of you. Appreciate it. Good arguments.
Good work.